This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to the program today. I appreciate you tuning in. This is Joel Hilliker. I'm going to call this the politically incorrect Trumpet Hour. Not that we're ever politically correct, but we have a couple of segments that would really raise the dander of a lot of people today. First, a story out of Britain showing that the Prime Minister's girlfriend is exerting undue influence on the government. A writer at the British Spectator called this Britain's first girlfriend problem. And this isn't a one-off story. It's indicative of a broad trend of how much power women are exercising in the world today, even in governments in today's world, in ways that people are generally unaware of. This is specifically prophesied in the Bible, and we're going to talk about that in our first segment. Then, critical race theory. This is a doctrine that's gaining more and more traction today in American education and politics, and it teaches that America is systemically racist. The Department of Education just announced it's going to set aside millions of taxpayer dollars to ensure this theory is taught in America's K through 12 schools. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller explaining what this is and why the Biden administration is promoting it. Then we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Josue Michels about the German Navy and signs that Germany is aiming to expand its global reach. It's just announced plans to send a frigate into the Indo-Pacific region this summer, so he will tell us about that. And to conclude the program, I'll share with you some thoughts I gave to the students at Imperial Academy. This is our K through 12 school on our campus here at the Trumpet offices, in their last forum of the school year about making the most of your summer. But let's start with this story about what the British Spectator calls the first girlfriend problem. The wife of an American president is called the first lady. Well, Britain doesn't have a president, it has a prime minister, and typically the spouse of the prime minister stays out of politics. But not so right now with Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is not married, but whose girlfriend, it increasingly appears, is exerting undue influence on him and on the affairs of the government. This is a quote from this Spectator article. Carrie Simmons herself is a perfectly nice, intelligent person who successfully worked her way through conservative campaign headquarters, but she is having too great an impact on the course of government. There are issues the prime minister avoids because she does not favor them, and there are others, principally green issues, which he appears to adopt to satisfy her. The feeling is growing that the first girlfriend wants political power without the trouble of having to run for office and to wield it without any resulting criticism. This is not a sustainable state of affairs. Now, this author, Douglas Murray, he talks about how this woman is influencing policy. He says she seems to have a desire to be involved in all personnel issues. Her principal ambition seems to be for her friends to make up all the central control flanks around the prime minister. And he says that if anyone criticizes her, they tend to get attacked for it. He writes this, in the UK, anyone who wishes to have political power should run for elected office. The emergent office of First Lady is clearly a source of tension in Downing Street and is already responsible for an unprecedented number of interventions in policy areas that affect our country. We hear nothing from the Prime Minister on issues he was elected on and far too much on ones that Carrie happens to favor, his girlfriend. The Prime Minister may have need of a first girlfriend, but the country does not. Very interesting perspective coming out of Britain. And how often is this happening with leaders in our world? And we don't hear about it. When we hear about women in politics, we hear really only about those who are actually in office. And we hear about how women are underrepresented and we need to get more women in power, and somehow this is going to solve society's problems. But what about situations like this? Women who aren't in office, but who are actually ruling. I guarantee this happens a lot more than people realize, and there are very few who would even say there's a problem here. I'm sure Douglas Murray took some flack for writing about this in The Spectator, but I believe we're seeing a similar situation with the man once known as Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan Markle. They haven't been married for 3 full years yet, and now they've had a very public and messy divorce with the British royal family. He stepped away from his royal duties. He's been stripped of his honorary military positions. They've trashed the reputation of the royal family. They've accused them of racism. And the reports are this is really all her doing. She found the royal life unbearable, she said. It made her want to commit suicide at times. She contemplated it, and she felt everyone was out to get her. There was a quote from a year or so ago from Angela Levin, a royal biographer, and she said that Prince Harry's relationship with this woman changed him completely. She said beforehand, this was just a short time ago, he was a charismatic, sincere man, that he was an open book. And she wrote this: less than a year on, however, I witnessed this warm young prince morph into a nervy, tense man who seems constantly on edge. It is as if the dark side that we had only had glimpses of previously have fully enveloped him. And this situation has been compared to what happened in 1936, the succession crisis, when Prince Edward VIII abdicated so that he could pursue marriage to an American divorcee, Wallace Simpson. How much is Meghan Markle, this woman, running the show? How much is she responsible for what's happened here with the royal family? It's an interesting question when you look at a prophecy of our day that you find in Isaiah 3. Isaiah 3 and verse 12 says, "As for my people," this is God speaking, "children are their oppressors and women rule over them." Women rule. Last week, Joe Biden gave a presidential address to both houses of Congress. A lot was made about the fact that both the vice president and the speaker of the House were women. He had Kamala Harris and Nancy Pelosi right behind him. And this was, of course, this was hailed as progress. But then there were people who also said, no, we have more work to do. We still have a man standing in front of those two women. Now, if you're only looking at the numbers of representatives in the House or the number of women senators, and you have this idea that, you know, women make up half the population, so they should make up half the seats in these governmental offices, well, you're going to say, clearly women don't rule. You know, there needs to be a lot more women ruling. But the reality is, Isaiah 3 and verse 12 is God's assessment of America and Britain today. He's talking about the nations of Israel, and America and Britain are the modern descendants of Israel. And that is who this prophecy is about. And God says, "As for my people, women rule over them." And if you really meditate on this, you see just how accurate this is. There's a lot of evidence all around us. Let me just read the first few verses of that chapter, chapter 3 in Isaiah. "For behold, the Lord, the Eternal of hosts, does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water, the mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet and the prudent and the ancient, the captain of 50 and the honorable man and the counselor and the cunning artificer and the eloquent orator. And I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them." This is a stark picture of the fact that God has removed strong male leadership. And why is that? Well, it's a curse. It's a curse from God because of our sin against God. God has removed all of this male leadership, And what does this mean? It means we have a more effeminate age. Everything is feminized. Effeminate thinking has taken over our politics, our business, and our economics, our education. It's taken over our whole society. Now, what do I mean by this? That everything is feminized. Well, today it seems most people reject the idea that there are differences between men and women. They get upset if you say that men tend to think this way and women tend to think that way. And what's interesting, of course, is it's often the same people who say we need more women in politics, which makes no sense if there are no natural differences between them in their thinking. It's only if you acknowledge the fact that men and women think differently that you would say that we need more women in politics. But there are differences. There are differences between the way men and women think. There are very different tendencies in the thinking of men versus the thinking of women. And women's thinking is taking over. And again, I'm talking about tendencies in how women think versus how men think. When Joe Biden gave that speech on Capitol Hill, backed up by those two women, part of what he laid out in that speech was a new plan that promises to radically change America. He called it the American Families Plan. And this is a massive spending plan, $1.8 trillion. And what is this about, the American Families Plan? Really, it is designed to give the government much more control over the thinking and the lives of Americans and young Americans in particular. It sets up government-funded preschool for 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds. It covers a lot of the cost of childcare for low-income families. It gives 12 weeks paid family medical leave. It extends the child tax credit through 2025. It establishes 2 years of government-funded community college. $1.8 trillion. America is $28 trillion in debt. And this is money the country does not have. But the president says, hey, we have to move forward with this. These are our priorities moving forward. Now, why such a priority on these social programs, these education programs that we cannot afford? Well, I think you can directly attribute it to the rise in feminist thinking in our government. These are not the priorities of a budget and a fiscal policy put together by a right-thinking masculine man. It simply isn't. And again, I'm talking about general tendencies. Generally, if a man is going to put his family in a deep financial hole, he's not going to do it to cover things like preschool and childcare and family medical leave and so on. And in this same speech, if you want more evidence, President Biden also urged Congress to pass the Violence Against Women Act, and this includes anti-gun provisions. It includes a pro-transgender provision. I think the way these policies and these causes are taking over the Democrat Party and American politics in general, it's also a sign of the fulfillment of Isaiah 3. All this government funding that's going to schools, it's going to education, what are our schools increasingly teaching our children? We'll talk about this in our second segment, but more and more of this is really akin to sensitivity training. We're teaching our kids how to get offended over silly things. We're teaching them how to walk on eggshells around other people to try to avoid offending them. This is from a Telegraph article a couple of weeks ago. The title, Woke Weaning is Coming to a School Near You and Parents Are Too Scared to Question It. This is from the UK, April 19th. And this author talks about a woman whose 11-year-old son was given what she called a talk at school after a woman was murdered in London. And in this talk, it says, quote, all the boys were taken aside and urged to respect girls and women. And this mom said, of course children should be educated about misogyny and harassment, but the narrative seemed to be that boys were by definition not just bad, but capable of extreme evil. That's a lot for an 11-year-old to take on. This is the quote from this mother who was concerned about what the school was teaching. And this author basically says that she was too afraid to actually state this publicly because she was afraid of the backlash that she would receive for criticizing what the school was doing. But what business do educators have filling boys' minds with that kind of message? That is strong evidence of women ruling. Right-thinking men would never do something like that. Of course, men need to respect girls and women. Of course, boys need to be taught that lesson. I teach my son that all the time in very specific ways. But there's more going on here than that. This is about making boys feel bad for being boys. That is perverse. In all of the ways that modern thinking encourages people to get offended over everything, telling people they're out of line and they need to apologize for everything. They're guilty before they've even done anything. This is like a toxic, overbearing mom that is guilt-tripping her children all the time. The way that free speech is being systematically shut down because we're so concerned about bruising people's feelings. Do men who really think like men implement these kinds of rules and policies? No. This is Isaiah 3 in action. The political correctness, the cancel culture that is getting worse and worse, people getting offended over every little thing. This is the way feminists think. That is effeminate. It's a very strange combination of effeminate fragility and emotion, just raw emotion over logic. The whole idea that, look, if I feel it, then that's truth. That is effeminate. That is a result of a loss in masculine boldness. Think about probably the biggest story of this entire last year, COVID-19 and all the lockdowns that took place. We have this virus that causes, you know, varying levels of symptoms in different people. A lot of people who get it have very little effect. Some have more serious effects. In some people, it's very serious. But we want to do everything we possibly can to keep everyone safe. Everyone has to wear masks, even our young children. We need to put everyone in bubble wrap. You can't be too cautious. We have to have an abundance of caution. We have to prioritize health and safety above everything else. We're so concerned about this, we are willing to shut our economies down to prevent this from spreading. Really, our entire government in America and several other countries, certainly in Britain, has turned into a domineering, overprotective mommy. It's a spectacular demonstration of the feminization of our world. There are too few real men to stand up to all of this and say, no, let's use some sense here. Let's exercise some logic. Let's have some courage, for crying out loud. We're not going to turn our lives completely upside down over the fear of a flu bug. Those men have been taken away. And look at the results. Look at the results. And at the same time that our government is dumping all this fake money into trying to indoctrinate 3- and 4-year-olds in government-sponsored preschools and into childcare and social programs, there are calls to pull money out of law enforcement and out of the military, out of defense spending, these fields that are very male-dominated and that really represent strong male authority in society, in our domestic policy, in our foreign policy. We have prominent women in politics like Nancy Pelosi and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib and Kamala Harris saying that we need to defund and effectively dismantle the police. The police. That is effeminate thinking. Now, what's interesting is some people would say, well, cutting back on defense spending and that type of thing, that's exactly why we need more women in politics, because they don't make war like men do. So they would actually acknowledge, well, this really is one of the fundamental differences between women and men. And, you know, the more effeminate thinking or the more womanly type thinking that we can get in government, the better off we're going to be. That is very, very misguided. Obviously, God hates war. Even men shouldn't be in war. But if they go to war, if we're going to war, we better do it in a manly way. We need to be masculine warriors. When a nation starts thinking like women, then it's going to draw back until it is destroyed. It becomes enslaved physically and spiritually. Women are just as important as men, but God intends for them to play a very different role than men in the family and in society. When we depart from that, we run into serious problems. When women are taking over and making these kinds of decisions, we've got serious problems. When men are not fulfilling their role, we run into serious problems. And Isaiah 3 paints the picture of exactly what is happening on a massive scale today. As for my people, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. Everything is upside down and we're seeing the effects. God wants men to be masculine. We have to build this quality and exhibit this quality that Isaiah says has disappeared. We as men have a responsibility. We cannot abdicate our God-given role in society or in our families. God expects us to take the lead. There must be masculine energy. There must be masculine thinking. Look around at what is happening in society today and behold the effects of this curse, the loss of masculine leadership and of women ruling.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Biden administration has gone all in with the idea that America is systemically racist, even to the point of committing taxpayer dollars to ensuring that our K-12 schools teach this to our children. We'll now hear about this in this report from Andrew Miller.
Few people outside academia have ever heard of critical race theory. At least that was true before President Donald Trump banned the teaching of this malign ideology to federal employees. But now, you can barely make it a week without reading some headline about this philosophy. Joe Biden rescinded President Trump's executive order on his first afternoon in the Oval Office. Now he wants to pay schools to teach ideas from the New York Times 1619 Project and from critical race theorist Ibram X. Kendi. On April 19th, the Department of Education announced that officials are setting aside $5.3 million in taxpayer money for K-12 schools to teach that America is systematically racist. Specifically, the Department of Education wants to teach values being promoted by the 1619 Project, the National Museum for African American History and Culture, and Ibram X. Kendi. The 1619 Project says the U.S. was founded not in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, but 157 years earlier when the first African slaves arrived. The National Museum of African American History and Culture says valuing things such as the nuclear family, self-reliance, and objective rational linear thinking are manifestations of white culture. And Kendi says America needs a Department of Anti-Racism with the power to abolish any law at any level of government deemed insufficiently anti-racist. According to the Department of Education, these steps are necessary to advance racial equity and better support underserved communities. Yet Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and three dozen other Republicans wrote a letter to the Secretary of Education noting that this is a time to strengthen the teaching of civics and American history in our schools, not a time to double down on divisive, radical, and historically dubious buzzwords and propaganda like the 1619 Project. Cornell Law School professor William Jacobson maintains a website which features a list of more than 300 colleges and universities promoting critical race theory. And the Biden administration wants to spread critical race theory to America's K-12 schools. It is evident that this neo-Marxist philosophy is quickly becoming institutional orthodoxy in the United States. So it is vital for all Americans to understand what critical race theory is and where it comes from. Marxism was built on the theory of class conflict. Karl Marx believed that the only way to end poverty was for the working class to overthrow the capitalist class in a violent revolution. But Marxism only became popular in feudal societies like Russia and China, where the people were poor and desperate enough to risk everything in a people's revolution. In free market societies like the United States, people could escape poverty through education, hard work, and good citizenship. So the theory of class conflict never took root in the United States like it did in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Rather than give up on their dream of a socialist society, however, Marxist scholars in the United States substituted race for class and sought to create a revolutionary coalition of ethnic minorities against a white majority. In 1989, a group of students organized a retreat titled New Developments in Critical Race Theory that effectively created a new kind of communism where race conflict replaced class conflict in the quest to overthrow capitalism and replace it with socialism. This is why Ibram Kendi says, in order to be truly anti-racist, you also have to be truly anti-capitalist. His ideology is not a way to overthrow racism. It is a way to overthrow capitalism. As Christopher Rufo explained in his essay, Critical Race Theory, What It Is and How to Fight It, an equity-based form of government would mean the end not only of private property, but also of individual rights, equality under the law, federalism, and freedom of speech. These would be replaced with race-based redistribution of wealth, group-based rights, active discrimination, and omnipotent bureaucratic authority. Historically, the accusations of anti-Americanism have been overused, but in this case, it's not a matter of interpretation. Critical race theory prescribes a revolutionary program that would overturn the principles of the Declaration of Independence and destroy the remaining structures of the U.S. Constitution. It was the original intent of Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin to have an image of the Anglo-Saxon kings Hengist and Horsa on one side of the Great Seal of the United States, and an image of Moses and the Israelites following a pillar of fire out of Egypt on the other side. They recognized the similarities between Anglo-Saxon common law and the laws of ancient Israel, and they based the U.S. Constitution on these commonalities in an effort to realize the words engraved on the Liberty Bell, "Proclaim liberty through all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof," which is actually a direct quote from Leviticus 25 and verse 10. Contrary to what many leftists claim, it was a hypocritical failure to apply the principles contained in America's founding documents that enabled slavery to exist in the United States. And it was the language of the Declaration of Independence and the legal structures of the Constitution that empowered Congress to emancipate slaves and make them full citizens of the United States. In his article, The Real Agenda Behind Black Lives Matter, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry writes, "Liberals and academia and the judiciary have long fought legal battles to undermine the U.S. Constitution. Yet the truth is that the America's Constitution has given more freedom to more people than any other government charter in history. It was the system this document built that allowed the United States to become one of the first societies in history to completely abolish slavery, The U.S. Constitution is a noble document that has inspired and enabled so many to attain accomplishments that any other system anywhere else in the world would have denied them. Yet today, critical race theorists are trying to destroy the Constitution so they can replace it with a new system based on the redistribution of wealth and omnipotent bureaucratic authority. These radicals believe that if they can convince millions of Americans that their nation's governing structures are systematically racist, they can create a revolutionary coalition of the dispossessed with the power to conquer the nation. Yet both history and Bible prophecy show that their efforts to create a revolutionary coalition will only end in civil war. During the heights of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the late Herbert W. Armstrong wrote from a unique perspective, neither black nor white, Republican nor Democrat, but based on the eternal truths of the Bible. Mr. Armstrong taught the way to true peace and correctly identified the problems plaguing race relations. Yet he also understood what the Bible prophesies for the new future. He wrote in the October 1963 Plain Truth, "Make no mistake, this is no light matter to pass over casually. Race war is coming. Racial tensions, passions, and hatreds are being deliberately stirred up by organized planning. It will explode into mass violence that will stagger the imagination. It will be whipped into an accelerating crescendo until human blood flows like rivers." Now, his warning highlighted the fact that racial violence in America is not happening because of an innate hatred between races. It is being stirred up by radical politicians, many of whom are trying to scare people into voting for them. In the 1960s, this tactic spiraled out of control as hundreds of people took to the streets to riot, and it is about to spiral out of control again, only in a much, much bigger way. A sobering prophecy in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 shows that end-time Israel will be cursed with race problems as a result of its rebellion against God's law. This verse says, "Your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land, strangers devour it in your presence, it is desolate as devoured by strangers." So this is a terrifying passage about non-Israelites rioting in the cities of end-time Israel. And a related prophecy in Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 reveals that one-third of the population of America and Britain will die from pestilence, famine, and violence that result from civil war. That's 10 times more than died in the devastating civil war unleashed by Russia's Bolshevik Revolution. The coming violence in America's cities is punishment, but it is punishment with a purpose. God will use this violence to show us the results of sin and turning away from Him to our own ways of thinking. He will use it to lead us to Him. God blessed Abraham for his obedience to His law, and his descendants were supposed to follow His example. Only after people learn this lesson will God bless America and all other nations with peace, joy, and prosperity.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Germany is aiming to expand its global reach, including plans it has announced to expand the power of its navy. We'll learn about this in this report from Josue Michels.
As many know, Germany is an export champion and consistently in the top three of the world's largest exporters. In this category, Germany is only surpassed by China and the United States. Germany is also one of the largest weapon exporters in the world, and its diplomatic skills enjoy a high reputation. Also remarkable is that German shipping companies own the world's fourth largest trading and container ship fleet. That too is remarkable from a comparatively small country with a rather small coastline. Now Germany is starting to test the waters by increasing its military presence into the Indo-Pacific. The German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas stated in a foreign policy paper from last August, quote, "Germany maintains strategic partnerships with a number of countries in the region with a large intersection of common interests. However, we must go further. The prosperity of our society depends on open seaways, physical and digital connectivity, and participation in functioning growth markets. Together with the European Union, Germany has big goals. To protect the world's open seaways is no small task. Just recently, we have seen what damage it can cause when one of these waterways is blocked, as a container ship got stuck in the Suez Canal. Germany thus wants to back its economic power with a military presence. In the end of April, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer announced that Germany will send a frigate into the Pacific this summer. This is certainly a small step, but it shows Germany's ambition. The European Union seeks to protect its interests globally. This shows for once how tense the situation globally is and how little they trust in the US. Kramp-Karrenbauer also indicated that German naval officers would be deployed on Australian ships. Australia's media has interpreted Germany's move as a sign of great solidarity in its effort to confront China's dominance in the region. But its euphoria may be short-lived. Germany has its own global ambition, and it hopes to avoid offending China. Germany's foreign policy paper stated, quote, "With the rise of Asia, the political and economic balance is increasingly shifting to the Indo-Pacific region. The region is becoming key to shaping the international order in the 21st century." End of quote. Germany doesn't want to be left out of this decisive battlefield and is now taking concrete action. In an online discussion hosted by Australian think tank ASPI last November, Kramp-Karrenbauer announced that Germany was seeking a military presence in the Indo-Pacific. Officials in Berlin have long considered sending a warship through the strait between China and Taiwan. Germany's Die Welt noted on April 29th, a German frigate in the strait would have been a strong sign of support for Taiwan. But it remained a mere thought experiment. A German frigate never set sail for the Pacific. End of quote. That is now set to change. Yet the frigate will still avoid the strait between China and Taiwan. Berlin considers the Taiwan Strait international waters, yet China claims the strait for itself. Defending the international waters would mean confronting China. Germany, at least for now, has no such plans. China is one of Germany's most important trading partners. Germany's Die Welt continued, Brussels and Berlin agree that Europe's security is also decided in the Pacific. The German Navy is therefore to show presence in this region. But an important strait between China and Taiwan is off limits. Is this a genuflection before Beijing? End of quote. Although Germany is to reduce economic dependence on China and strengthen multilateralism, human rights and free trade with Pacific partners, there is no expectation of a total break between Germany and China. Free Democrat and Member of Parliament Ulrich Lecht noted, quote, "After Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer's announcement of engagement in the Indo-Pacific, we actually expected something other than such a kowtowing to China." The European Union's papers, however, highlight the importance of a meaningful European naval presence in the Indo-Pacific, according to Politico. The aim of the strategy is to become more involved in the region, and that includes a military presence. Berlin and Brussels are formulating a global joint strategy. As the United States works to withdraw, Europe is working to build its presence in the region, so we can expect Europe's military presence to increase globally. Europe's global ambition reveals that its legislators are thinking more and more in terms of empire. At the Trumpet, we have expected this change for decades. The Bible reveals in Daniel 2 that four successive world-ruling empires would rule this world prior to the return of Jesus Christ. Bible prophecy and secular history reveal that the Roman Empire is the last of these empires. The empires described in Daniel 2 are also described in Daniel 7 as four beasts. Concerning the Roman Empire, the prophet Daniel recorded in chapter 7, verse 19 and verse 22, "Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom." The Roman Empire's traditions are continually upheld and resurrected in Europe through the efforts of the Roman Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire. We see those same traditions alive in Europe today. The Roman Empire, through various resurrections, was prophesied to be the last human kingdom to rule this world. And within that empire, there would be seven resurrections guided by the Catholic Church. From Justinian to Hitler, we have seen six of these resurrections already, and the Roman Catholic Church continues to guide European politicians and policies today. The Treaty of Rome brought about the creation of the European Economic Community. Its successor, the European Union, is working to build a military empire. God's prophecies are being fulfilled right before our eyes. Isaiah 23 speaks of another end-time prophecy in which the resurrected Holy Roman Empire is in a trade alliance with China. This prophecy is playing out today as well. As Europe moves into the Indo-Pacific and builds its military might, it is careful to not offend China too much. It knows the value of keeping China as a trade partner. Such dealings with China will eventually lead to what is prophesied in Isaiah 23. For more on this specific prophecy, please read chapter 7 of Isaiah's End Time Vision. I encourage you to also request and read a free copy of The Proof of the Bible. This short booklet, found on our website thetrumpet.com, will open your eyes to the Bible's remarkable accuracy and hope in Almighty God.
Thank you very much, Josue. So this is an interesting announcement from Germany, extending its naval presence in the Pacific. When you view this, this is probably something that a lot of people wouldn't necessarily raise a tremendous amount of concern over. You are obviously looking at it in light of these prophecies that we talk about a lot at the Trumpet, about Germany's military might increasing dramatically in the end time. You view this in the context of several other events. You talked about Germany's arms exports and its military arms manufacturing. What else do you see as contributing to this this signal of Germany's global ambitions?
Yes, we see China's global rise to power, and they are obviously in a trade alliance, but Germany is also afraid that they will be losing out in that competition. So as part of the new papers they outlined, they're saying they're going to ally themselves also with more nations surrounding China and have more trade deals with them to undermine China's power. And obviously they want a more military presence in that region for that reason. So that's definitely playing into that. We also have seen similar developments in the Middle East, where Germany is increasingly getting involved there because they fear the rise of Iran, and they are building military alliances with Saudi Arabia and other nations. Just recently they have offered financial aid to Syria for political change there, that they will be more aligned with Europe as they used to be in opposition against Iran, and quite a few military deals have been struck with countries in that region, and they also have sent an increasing military presence in some of those countries as well.
So You talked about how Australia is looking at this. Australia is obviously very concerned about China's rise. They just canceled a couple of trade deals with China that that demonstrate just how concerned they are about what China is up to. Germany's move seems to be a bit of a pushback against China, and Australia is excited about this. What do you expect to come from the future of Australia-Germany relations?
Yes, that's a remarkable part of all of this, because Australia is increasingly standing up against China. For the longest time, they've been allied with them and had no concern whatsoever, but they're seeing what China does to other countries, and they're getting a little bit concerned about that. So Germany is having its rhetoric moved against China, and also a little bit of a military presence there. But China and Germany are so interdependent these days, and they are much more concerned about their own trade alliances. Otherwise, those would have broken much earlier because of many more infractions that China has already committed in its own country and in neighboring countries. So we are not expecting a break between Germany and China. To the contrary, Bible prophecy indicates that they will be allying themselves, even to the point that they will turn against other nations, like the English-speaking nations. Bible prophecy indicates directly in Ezekiel 23 that there will be alliances that will direct themselves against those nations. Specifically, this prophecy shows that the people, the English-speaking people, referred to in Bible prophecy as Israel, as they are the modern descendants of the ancient people, will be in love or allied in a strong union with Germany these days, and putting their trust in Germany. Verse 9 of that chapter reads, "Wherefore I have delivered her into the hands of her lovers, into the hands of the Assyrians, upon whom she doted." So this prophecy shows that the English-speaking people will be in a close alliance with Germany, but that Germany will then betray them.
Well, we appreciate you looking into this for us. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about Germany's increasing global ambitions. He's written an article, "New Pacific Mission, Germany, an Aspiring Global Power." You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Josue.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
In some ways, time is our greatest asset. We all get 24 hours a day, 1,440 minutes, 86,400 seconds. Now, that sounds like a lot, but it goes by quick. And somehow it's when you're least busy that you can waste the most time. I've realized I do best when I'm precisely regulating my time. The more, the better. I've built a system over a period of years. And doing this, I've been doing something specific that really has helped me to get good results. I've realized how much you can accomplish even in little bits of time when you're making use of them and you're doing it consistently, even 5 or 10 minutes a day at something. It's very easy to squander time, especially when you don't have a firm schedule. And that's why it's important to be aware of this and to set goals about how to use your time. Henry Ford said, "It has been my observation that most people get ahead during the time that others waste." Many students are about to enter summer vacation here at Imperial Academy. They finished school this week, and I gave them a forum asking them, "What are you going to do with your summer?" Last summer, we changed the name of our summer camp here from Philadelphia Youth Camp to the Summer Education Program. This is an education program. Education doesn't stop when the school year ends. We all need to keep up our education our whole life long. Even that summer camp is only 3 weeks. There's a lot more to a summer than just 3 weeks. And I encourage those students to establish their own summer education program. And I'd like to share what I gave them with you and encourage you to consider doing the same. Set some summer goals to make the best use of these next few months. With some planning and goal setting, you can accomplish a lot more than you think. You know that when school ends, that doesn't mean your education stops. It just means that more of the responsibility for your education falls on your shoulders. And that's a good thing. That gives you the opportunity to grow in self-motivation. Proverbs 15 and verse 14 says, "The heart of him that has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of fools feeds on foolishness." So there's a contrast here between a person who already has enough understanding to know that he needs more understanding. The heart seeks knowledge. This is coming from deep within this person. And then this other person, this fool, who feeds on foolishness. What do you do? Do you seek knowledge or do you feed on foolishness? There's a big difference, and there's a lot of foolishness out there. What are you going after? You know, when our schedule is really structured, you might not have a lot of time to feed on foolishness. But when the schedule lightens up, well, that's when you start to see what you're really made of, such as summer for students. What are you going to do with that extra time? Will you seek knowledge or feed on foolishness? Proverbs 18 and verse 15 says, "The heart of the prudent gets knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge." So again, here's somebody who already has some understanding. Revised Standard Version says, "An intelligent mind acquires knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge." So the more understanding you have, the more you realize you need more. And this verse says, if you're seeking it, you're going to get it. I feel like the older I get and the more I learn, the more I want to learn, the more hungry and curious my mind becomes. I realize how little I know and how much more I want to know. We all want to reach the point where learning is a real pleasure and we go after more learning. Books are an outstanding resource. It's like sitting down and having a conversation with some of the most outstanding people in history as they wrestle with some of the most important events in history and the greatest questions facing mankind. Seneca said, "Books are the training weights of the mind." What lessons can you learn from knowing more about history, about economics, government, warfare, language, poetry, science? What can you learn from Winston Churchill or Abraham Lincoln or George Washington? What can you learn from the history of the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic, ancient Greece, Persia, Cyrus, Babylon? How much can that vitalize your mind and excite you even more about the truth of God? And of course, there's a lot more to life than books. What about learning skills, things that you can do with your hands? What about building, gardening? What about exercise? What about serving other people? What are your interests that are more difficult to devote attention to when life is busier? Devote some time to those during the summer. Proverbs 19 and verse 8 says, "He that gets wisdom loves his own soul. He that keeps understanding shall find good." When you get wisdom, you're helping yourself. You're enriching your own life. The New International Version says, "The one who gets wisdom loves life, and the one who cherishes understanding will soon prosper." So don't just get it, but keep it, cherish it, use it, and you're going to prosper. Now, how can you map out your own summer educational program? That means setting specific goals, specific things you can do each day or each week to propel you toward what you're trying to achieve. And to those students, I talked about some areas that they could set some goals in. In work, maybe get a summer job, save a certain amount of money by the end of the summer, spend 3 hours a week doing yard work, grow a garden, learn a skill like how to fix a leaky faucet, or learn to lay bricks and build a retaining wall around your garden. You might set goals in fitness, deciding that you're not going to have any desserts from Sunday through Thursday each week, or you're going to exercise 4 times a week, or you're going to get enough strength to get a pull-up or 10 pull-ups, or 5 bar dips or 12 handstand push-ups. You might set goals with your relationships to have a good family night once a week, or to have a date between mom and a son, or a daughter and a father, or go for a walk as a family once a week, something like that, or contact a friend once per week. You can certainly set goals for reading. This is really important. Choose a challenging book and read 50 pages a week or 100 pages a week. Read one big book per month, so you'll get 3 of them done over the summer. Map out some Bible study goals, a list of booklets that you want to go through, or books of the Bible that you want to read. You might set a goal to keep a journal and write in that regularly. Record your thoughts as you're doing all of these other things. You might set a goal to take a trip to visit a museum or do something that you wouldn't have the opportunity to do educationally at other times. Orison Swett Marden wrote a book called Pushing to the Front, and there's a whole chapter in it called Possibilities in Spare Moments. It says, 1 hour a day withdrawn from frivolous pursuits and profitably employed would enable any man of ordinary capacity to master a complete science. 1 hour a day would, in 10 years, make an ignorant man a well-informed man. An hour a day might make, nay, has made, an unknown man a famous one, a useless man a benefactor to humanity. Consider then the mighty possibilities of 2, 4, yes, 6 hours a day that are, on the average, thrown away by young men and women in the restless desire for fun and diversion. What can you accomplish in your spare moments? Break down those difficult tasks into smaller, manageable tasks. What can you accomplish by studying a foreign language for 5 minutes a day? How you use even your spare moments can be one of the biggest differences between the person who is thriving and the person who's just drifting along. Build a habit of applying your spare moments to useful tasks. Every moment has value. So don't squander the present moment. Put it to good use, and every moment can be just as valuable as any moment. Map out your personal summer education program. Set some goals for the summer, and make the very most of these next 3 months. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller and Josue Michels. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Nora Roberts. If you don't go after what you want, you'll never have it. If you don't ask, the answer is always no. If you don't step forward, you're always in the same place. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.